Hello and welcome to Path to Power, episode 12. I'm Matt Cooper.
And I'm Ivan Yates.
And while the government has gone on its travels, we're here holding the fort. And as it's Cheltenham Week, I'm going to be talking to Ivan about the wasted money in supporting the horse and greyhound industries in this country, just indulging his little pet project. But before we get to that, it's time to talk about the outcome of the referendums and the fallout from it. And we got lots of your emails in to mail@pathtopowerpodcast.com, and thank you for those. And I particularly enjoyed all of those that were trolling Ivan on the basis that two things. One, the great gambler had predicted a yes outcome, no, and he lost on that. Excuse me, you did. And also that he had gone, and here is where I am willingly going to throw €20 into the swear bucket. Ivan has gone woke. That was what a lot of them had to give out to you about, that you'd gone woke with your yes, and you were on the wrong side.
Well, first of all, Just a couple of things on the result, because last week I said to you beforehand, I'd like to make a prediction. You said, I don't know whether it was moratorium, BAI rules, Commission Naumann rules, but you said I couldn't make a prediction. A couple of things. First of all, the biggest losers of all in this historic outcome, because the biggest defeat ever for a government, are the pollsters. Because every anecdote, I met one person in Castlebar, another person I really respect in Wexford, who's a very good reader scene, and they both said to me about a fortnight apart, I actually don't know anybody other than you, Ivan, who's voting yes. And that was kind of stark. And the second thing, I have a weather vane. Every Tuesday night, my wife plays poker with my money and invariably loses small money. But the point about it is she has a lot of fun. And these would be kind of women in their 60s, shall we say, mature women. And they said, way before the thing kicked off 3 weeks ago, well, I'm going to vote no. And all of them said that. And so every anecdote told me, this was before the carers one ran into specific trouble. But the pollsters did not show this. They showed something around 2-1 in favour. And they do have egg on their face.
I'm fascinated that Deirdre plays poker, because I got the impression from what you were saying a couple of weeks ago was bridge.
She plays bridge twice a week and poker once a week.
Okay. Well, it's a very interesting point you raised, which I hadn't thought about on the pollsters, because I'd extrapolate that on to political preferences when it comes to elections. And if you think back to the 2020 general election as well, the results were nothing like what the pollsters had predicted. And now we could have a situation whereby, you know, we get all the coverage that goes about Fianna Fáil's up 2, Fine Gael's down 2, Sinn Féin are up, now they're down. It could actually all be relatively meaningless by the time we get to the European local elections and then further on the general election.
Well, we shall see, but I do think there is a question to be raised about online polls when you're not actually face-to-face with someone, how accurate they are. But I just think...
So are you suggesting that people, when they're polled, act like Lisa Chambers, that they actually say that they're going to vote one way and then they do something else entirely?
Well, Lisa Chambers, I mean, like, there's so many aspects of this to get through. Lisa Chambers, I mean, if I was with the government and I voted no, would I tell anyone about it afterwards? I mean, trying to ride the winning horse afterwards, it just makes you look utterly disingenuous. Who advised her it'd be a good idea to come out publicly? Do what
Nobody
you want to
I
do.
Nobody, I imagine. I can't imagine anyone would have advised her
exactly,
that.
But no, but the point is, you're entitled to change your mind. You're entitled to vote in the privacy of the poem. But to go broadcast that you're a hypocrite is just mental.
Well, I'm amused by the idea that, I mean, think of what's going to happen to her on the canvas for the European elections. Every single person who says, Lisa, I'm giving you a vote, you're my number one, or I'll give you my transfer. And then afterwards, they'll be able to say, well, I told you that, Lisa, but I changed my mind afterwards when it came to going to the polling booth. I can't think of a greater act of political self-harm to actually go on radio and to try, as you say, ride the winning horse afterwards. Well, actually, I voted no, when there was photographic evidence of her having been on Grafton Street canvassing for Fianna Fáil, posing with other members. But then also, she was a member of the Oireachtas Committee that dealt with the Citizens Assembly recommendations in relation to this. So for her to turn around and say that she never wanted to take these references out of the Constitution completely flies in the face with the Oireachtas report that she signed off on.
Yeah. But there's a lot more people in the dock than Lisa Chambers.
But it is the funny one, actually. You know,
can I also say
it?
One thing that I thought came out of this before we get into the political meat of this? I think the moratorium should go. I think it is not fit for purpose because we had the leaking of the AG advice.
Which
within
I couldn't cover on the last word on the Thursday afternoon it broke. Well, we weren't aware of it until a little bit later. But we should have been able to cover that on Friday's programme while people were voting. And we were stopped from doing so. There's nothing to prevent online newspapers and their online versions, and nothing to prevent discussion amongst people on all forms of social media. And there were we in the broadcast media effectively gagged.
You know, it comes from an era where there was kind of almost una duce with RTE, when there was no local radio and so on. It is no longer fit for purpose. And we should actually, because, you know, you see in the American elections in the last 24 hours, they do about 18 different states and so on. It reaches a fever pitch. I mean, I just thought that, and I say this as an aside, the moratorium should just be binned.
You know, the other thing that struck me afterwards is the amount of people sort of post-rationalising how people voted. And a certain lobby who's out there saying, oh, it was all because the women of Ireland didn't want the reference to mother taken out of the Constitution. I wonder, I mean, as I think I said last week on this podcast, the problem wasn't what was been taken out of the Constitution. It was going back in. And I think possibly the most effective people in relation to the defeat of the referendum, there were two people that perhaps we should talk about, two senators, and maybe we'll get to Michael McDowell in a moment. But first, Senator Tom Clonan, the passion with which he spoke on behalf of people with disabilities and their carers was, I think, one of the most impactful things across the referendum campaign. And I suspect that made an awful lot of impact, more so perhaps than other people are than are claiming.
Yeah, but there was no particular reason why the government should have got into the whole carer agenda. The whole issue was a mother's duties in the home. And all you had to do, as the Citizens Assembly recommended, was take out the singular gender reference to women and just make it for parents.
Yeah.
And like, they actually opened a Pandora's box. And interestingly, in 2018, when Charlie Flanagan was Minister for Justice, this file was presented to him. And when he saw this Pandora's box, he said, we'll pass on this. We have a general election coming up in 2020. And sorry, so let's get into the politics of this, which is the raw meat of this. So I remember setbacks before in by-elections like the Senate one, but there was 4 years to go before a general election. The proximity of this to polling is really, really bad for the government, because there's a number of reasons. It was, first of all, Roderick O'Gorman, the line minister for this, comes out of it really badly. And I'm sorry to be repetitious about this, but following on what we've discussed on this podcast about the poor performance of Eamon Ryan, the ineffectiveness of Catherine Martin, Roderick O'Gorman and the immigrant issue has been not fit for purpose. He must take, and him and the three leaders must take prime responsibility for guillotining the Dáil debate, not listening. Like, I spoke to a number of backbenchers in Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, and you know what? They said in one voice, they don't listen. This is reference to Micheál and Leon. And in fact, let's put it right, they don't effing listen. And people are really pissed off with the fact that we've, for the last 3 or 4 years, they've been saying things about migrants, saying things about this isn't a real issue affecting people. The issues are housing and health and so on.
Well, that's very interesting, because I think you have put your finger on a point here. If they're not listening to their own parliamentary party members, then they're not listening to the public. And even now, in the way that they're responding, okay, they have to put a brave face on things as they all get out of the country to escape the wrath of the public. But saying that this has no implications or consequences for future elections, I don't buy. But it's not necessarily because of the specific referendum result. It's the referendum result feeds into the general public's perception of the government as being a bit arrogant and out of touch and not listening. And there's a distaste for the government, which is likely to, whatever the opinion polls say now about support for particular parties, be shown in the European and local elections. The issue then becomes is, where do the votes actually go to? And what candidates emerge? And how much surprise are we going to see with minority, what we might regard as fringe candidates, getting more votes than perhaps the establishment would expect?
Also, take another, like, so is this the end of the liberal agenda, abortion, contraception, divorce, marriage equality, and all of that? And I actually draw a distinction between the liberal agenda, and I'll happily pay my 20 euros, or what I call the woke agenda, which is a lot of other issues from transgender to other issues, which actually don't resonate with ordinary people. And can I give you an example? And this will upset...
So you're expanding the definition of the W word.
Okay.
Anyway, which has been deliberately done by the culture warriors.
Okay. Well, put it like this. I'm ignorant of what the culture wars are about, but put it like this.
No, you're not.
No, I'm sorry. I'm going to be offensive now in what I'm going to say, and you are going to recoil at this. You know they picked last Friday because it was International Women's Day?
Yes.
Do you know what? Where I drink and where I converse with ordinary people in
men rural, only, is
yeah,
it?
No, and rural Ireland, and in rural Ireland.
No, but sorry, is there only men in the pub?
No, mostly, right. But not exclusively. The point is this. They wouldn't know about International Women's Day, but by God, they knew Sunday was Mother's Day. And you know, when someone put out the dog whistle, mothers were being taken out of the Constitution. I mean, how someone couldn't see that for a lot of people outside of the NGO bubble, outside of the government bubble, outside of, God forgive me, the media bubble, you know, the reality is Mother's Day means a lot to a lot of people.
Well, funnily enough that you should say that, did you notice that in the Dáil, the Wednesday before International Women's Day, because they weren't sitting on the Friday because of the referendum, 2.5 hours was put aside for speeches about International Women's Day. And when Roderick O'Gorman opened the debate, do you know how many people were in the chamber?
Was there any?
He was the only one.
Yeah.
And people started drifting in, and people, mainly women and maybe the female leaders of the opposition parties. But even as Holly Kern said, she said, it's just the same stuff that they trotted out the previous year.
I tell you what people got mad. Working mothers, because the primary schools were all closed, actually had to take a day off work because they didn't have childcare, you know, situations where the kids over 4 or 5 would be in school. I mean, these things upset people, and they are mothers, you know. So that, put it like this, do you agree with me or not that, okay, let me throw it at you. We'll come to the hate speech legislation. We'll come to opening pubs till 6:30 in the morning. We'll come to assisted dying. We'll come to a lot of issues that are seen to be on the agenda, and you know what? They do not resonate with. Whereas, actually, how dare the church say, you know, what should happen in relation to remarriage? How dare the church to take away a woman's right to choose on abortion? I'll do what I like with my own contraception and so on. These were issues that I fought in politics, going back to Garrett's constitutional crusade to the 80s, which actually were worth fighting for. This woke agenda isn't worth fighting for.
But what do you describe as the woke agenda? Because how many things are actually trying to be put through, you know, all the things that you complain about? And Willie O'Dea was at it. And this thing about, he said, playing to the woke gallery. Jesus, we're kerching, kerching, kerching at the moment on the swear jar. But he actually has been playing this game since back last year. I found a press release or a blog he put up in July last year, having a go at Helen McEntee about this. But he actually doesn't really define what he means by woke. And I looked at it again. It's in the Oxford English Dictionary, and I don't have the absolute definition to hand. But it's been aware of racial discrimination and privilege. And, you know, that is fair enough. That is actually something that I think we should be, and particularly as we have more people coming into the country from outside the country, that we should be aware of the fact that often that they come from backgrounds where they are looking for economic advancement and looking for a better way of life, like generations of Irish people did when they went away, and like generations of Irish people suffered racist abuse in Britain and in America because they were Irish and in Australia. And we should be conscious and cognizant of that in the way that we think. But I don't see this enormous sort of woke agenda as such been pushed forward. Take, for example, the hate speech bill, which has gone
Can we take it? But like, can I just say, Matt, and you're going to be upset about
I'm
this.
I'm not going to be. I'm long past the stage of being upset by anything you say.
Someone said to me, and as a guy you probably wouldn't rate, Eddie Hobbs, he said, the mainstream media now don't report to the people, they report upwards to their political leaders. And I thought,
that's just nonsense. And in fairness...
No, he's talking about two things, is a media bubble consensus. But the other thing he's talking about, the default position of you and your likes is actually to cancel them. You actually don't take on what he's saying about a WHO treaty. You actually say, we're going to cancel this person. He's not worth listening. And that is part of the woke agenda. And that is part of the disconnect with ordinary people. There actually is a lot of people out there only waiting to give the establishment a kicking in June, in October, simply because they feel they're not being listened to. They're being looked down at. Okay. They're being patronised.
Let me come back to that in a different way, because you spoke earlier about the moratorium being an issue. And I think, if I remember correctly, but please, if I'm wrong, correct me, that you complained a couple of weeks ago about the 50-50 balance that's required in the referendum campaigns.
Yeah, I know. I said it gave a huge opening to the no side, who might not be numerically represented. Like, it was manna from heaven for Padraig Tobin, because he was actually frontline, because he was the only TD other than Catherine Connolly who came out. Okay. In fact, he was the only one who came out for negative to both of them.
Well, now you've actually opened the door to me to make the point I want to make about what we might use the expression platforming fringe opinions. This idea that there's two equal sides to every story does not necessarily hold. And there are certain people that I would not put on radio because they hold opinions that are not just offensive. I've no problem with putting offensive people on air. God, I put you to air and I do a podcast with
you. Just have a problem with free speech, is it?
No,
a free expression.
I have no problem with free speech, but I do believe in that there is the thing like you can't cry fire in a crowded room. That there are actually certain things that, you know, that if people are trying to incite violence, are subtly trying to provoke racist attitudes, are to get people that they wouldn't do it themselves, but they'd certainly provoke others who would go and burn immigrant centres.
Can I make a net point here? Because I think you're throwing the baby out of the bathwater. I recently saw...
I know I'm far too woke to throw a baby out of anything.
So I looked at this video because I have a good friend in the Gardaí who sent me all sorts of videos. This was Angus O'Snoddy canvassing in houses somewhere in his constituency in Dublin South Central. And someone came along with a camera.
Oh, not one of these citizen journalists.
And made outrageous accusations about Sinn Féin being part of, you know, the consensus and so on. And actually, when you look at it, he made outrageous allegations about his sons and so on. The point I'm making is this. That actually isn't abuse. That's actually intimidation. That's actually saying you've no right to do your democratic job of knocking on doors or whatever. And I totally agree with you in terms of hate speech or whatever, that we have crossed a line whereby people are actually trying to bully people. They may have no mandate for what they're saying. But
that's what the hate speech bill is about. It's not about denying people the right to free speech. This is being misrepresented. That is to show to have the Garda investigations if you say something that's unpopular. It's actually quite clearly defined that when it is things like intimidation, when it causes fear, when it could bring about a situation where somebody is going to be attacked because of their sexuality, because of their ethnicity. Those are the type of things that are covered. But as part of these culture wars, there's a small element now getting supported by people who should know better, who are trying to say that this hate speech legislation is about stopping debate. Stopping the type of conversations that we are having here, which would not be stopped.
People who should know better. This implies you know best. So, let's come back to that.
Oh, I know I don't know as much as you, Ivan.
No. The point is this. I listen to your opinions. I just think we need to be more open about it. We'll come back to hate speech. Let's talk about political fallout.
Sorry, when you talk about listening to opinions, I mean, do you actually think we should be putting people on radio who say, well, you know, actually, and I'm going to use some of the language that they use here, these immigrants, they've been placed here because the government is under the instructions of the World Economic Forum, and all of these men of fighting age are being put into position so that when they're called to arms that they can lead an uprising, an insurrection against the state. That's what I have heard. People have told me this. I go to pubs as well occasionally, Ivan. I've heard you say, now, do you think that when you have crackpot ideas like that, that they should be put on radio? Because this is something interesting and we don't want to cancel people who have crazy ideas like that.
We'll put it like this. And I do want to come on to the politics and what all this means for the journal. But I was actually speaking to one of the top officials in relation to some of the changes in migration housing policy. And I said to him, do you mind me asking you an idiot's and I have an idiot question. I said, why did I see yesterday, going into Petits, an Ukrainian couple, and the guy was there? What is the story about conscription? And he made a very effective point that conscription policy is for only people over 27 and over 55, and under 55, I should say. And that actually they have a deliberate policy about that in terms of families, because they're looking at the next phase of rebuild, which I thought was interesting and maybe explains a lot. But what I want to get on
to... No, I want you to answer my question, which was in relation to, should I be putting people on air who want to come forward with theories about armies of foreign men being put in place to get the call at some stage? Well, the same people who actually, in many cases, were saying that when you got injected with the vaccine against COVID, that you were being microchipped.
So can I say this? Anyone who has a mandate, has been elected by the people, is worth listening
and
to.
And I do.
It's not, it's worth listening. And you have to respect their mandate, because they can be fired at the next election. So if you think that Matty Cahill or someone is an idiot, you should still have them on the programme.
And we do, actually. Sorry, when people are elected, even if we find their views, I mean, I might find their views objectionable. I talk to lots of politicians from all parties who I might find their views objectionable, and they're treated with respect. And they're but I'm talking about the people who were out doing the protests outside the immigrant centres and whatever, and who have these fringe theories.
No, and these selfies on a stick.
Yeah, suggesting that?
No, I'm not suggesting that. Okay. So what I'm saying here is this. So I spoke about the societal thing. It's the end of the liberal agenda, and they're not going to engage with the woke agenda. In my opinion, the silent majority. In terms of historically important, it's the biggest ever kicking the government got. Now let's look at the political fallout of this. So first of all, you know, I have said to you repeatedly that my sense of Fine Gael is, with retirements and everything else, 25, maximum 28 seats in dire trouble. But actually, Fine Gael, if you speak to backbenchers, they actually accept their fate. They said, look, we've had a great run since 2011. There's problems in government. They say about Leo, that relative to Enda Kenny, that actually he's very cerebral, but he actually doesn't get things done. And they actually say Martin Fraser and Enda Kenny might only have 3 or 4 points on their agenda, but they were effing and blinding as secretary generals to get things done. That doesn't happen anymore. Everything gets stuck in committee-itis. There is very much a hands-off policy.
They wish they hadn't got the referendums done.
So you've got to ask the question. I don't think it was an unreasonable proposition, whatever about the wording, to say we should expand the definition of family to include all sorts of different people. I don't think it's a bad idea to take out of the Constitution a woman's duties in the home. So why did it fail? Well, first of all, for a lot of people, if the government proposed tomorrow is Saturday, they'd come out against it. So let's face that. There is now an anger out there. And I think for Fianna Fáil, this is really serious. Because it now looks like on some of the, and I take some of this with a pinch of salt, but they did some AI GPT, you tell me, Sunday Independent analysis of who voted against it.
Oh, sorry, there was an exit poll and they actually did the analysis.
Up to 90% in rural Ireland of people who said, I'm Fianna Fáil, voted against it. And you have to ask the question, where is the Fianna Fáil frontbench? So you have Micheál, whose approval ratings are actually distorted because you know what? It's Fine Gael voters love him. They actually wish he was leading Fine Gael, and that is why he's getting 47%, because Fine Gael voters prefer him. But do you think...
That's a very good point.
Do you think that those same Fine Gael supporters are going to vote Fianna Fáil? I don't think necessarily.
They're not transfer.
They will. But the point about it is this. I'm just wondering. So Mary Butler was out. Lisa Chambers was out. So where was the...
Neve Smith is another one who said she was no.
Yeah, but who was there actually to say, we're Fianna Fáil in this airline? There was no frontline minister has come out before or since on this issue. Where is Anne Rabbitt, the Minister for Disabilities, when, as you say, Tom Clonan came up with this, the minister whose job it is to represent the disabled within the political representation of government, was not to be seen. And I mean, where is the discipline? And because the way a party works is this, in government, every Thursday, the Fine Gael frontbench ministers, when I was in government, would meet for lunch. And we would just have a political chat about the situation. I am just wondering whether it's Dara, whether it's Michael McGrath, like you just cannot go AWOL on this, because what this is about is political capital. If you invest it and you say, we think this is important, we're looking for your vote on this, and it gets trounced, what you've actually done there politically is devalue your political capital, devalue your authority, and that's going to come back and bite you for an election that you do care about.
Well, it's interesting that you mention about the Fianna Fáil and rural Ireland support being overwhelmingly no, but if you take it on an entirely national basis, the party which supporters had the biggest no vote was actually Sinn Féin. So this was...
I didn't see that. No, actually. Yeah. Yes, you're right.
So you actually...
Is that in working class areas?
No, this was just overall, nationwide, right?
Okay.
So you have this situation whereby Sinn Féin, I think one government, unnamed government minister said Sinn Féin missed an open goal on this.
They did.
So Sinn Féin...
Just for pure opportunism.
Yeah. And now they're trying to come back and say, well, we won't be rerunning the referendum, which I think they had indicated they would if they were in power. They're maintaining a reasonably low profile. But the thing is, if the majority of intended Sinn Féin voters voted no in the referendum, it does imply as well that this thing, which, again, with a pinch of salt, given how realistic are the polls, but could it be that Sinn Féin is in a bit of bother as well, because it is now becoming regarded as well by people
as
part of the consensus and the establishment, and it goes on the same side as the middle ground parties. And then the middle ground voters, where are the middle ground voters going to go? Because these middle ground Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil voters, do they really
vote Sinn Féin? Like, I actually, on reflection, I think there is a ceiling on how well Sinn Féin could do. It's about 30%. But I put it like this, there is no way, in my opinion, over 55s that are traditionally either Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil will vote Sinn Féin, but what they will do is they'll vote for independence.
But then the thing that keeps raising its head and has come back this week, I mean, it was interesting to see Jim O'Callaghan of Fianna Fáil, and I had him on The Last Word talking about this, this disgraceful situation outside the International Protection Applicants Office down just off Mount Street, where you have about 200 people in about 150 tents at present in miserable weather, because it was either freezing a few weeks ago or now it's been raining in recent days, and you have illnesses spreading. And this is dreadful that we have this situation. But I wonder, is it that the government is, in its own sneaky way, without saying we are closed to international protection asylum, but saying it's going to be so miserable if you come here, don't bother coming here, that
absolutely.
The word goes out.
That message has been put. And not only that, what they're going to do is all Ukrainians here are going to lose their job seekers allowance.
Well, this is actually, that's only, the thing that was brought in this week is only for new arrivals. That's right, after 90 days.
Heather Humphreys has come out and say it's going to be for the whole lot, we can't afford to sustain this.
Well, which is something, funnily enough, that Mary Lou MacDonald indicated as a Sinn Féin position previously as well. So you have this situation where I think we look as if we're trying to deal with the immigration issue by the back door. And even this week, the European People's Party, to which Fine Gael is aligned, it has its own mini Rwanda, shall we say, approach that it wants to take, like the way the British wanted to take people arriving in Britain and send them to Rwanda to be processed. And they would either stay in Rwanda if they were accepted, or they would be sent back to the country of origin. The European People's Party wants the same for Europe. Which raises the question, if that's the agenda to which Fine Gael signs up, will Fine Gael be actually campaigning itself in the European and local elections and that? Because if it does, it would raise the very valid question from voters as well. Actually, lads, you're in government. If this is what you believe in and you're now campaigning for votes on for the European Parliament, why don't you just simply do it in Ireland? And I'm still think, I remember back at the end of July, there was this decision by the government to issue a tender for charter flights to get rid of deported people. But I think even liberals will have to say that if you're running a deportation system, if you have an application system, not everybody can actually qualify from it, and that you actually have to actually give it a certain degree of, what would be the word that I would use for it, that it would be actually respected, that you actually have to have deportations. And what Jim O'Callaghan is pushing, and I believe other Fianna Fáil people are pushing now as well, which I think will happen, is an expansion of what's called the safe country list. We have only 10...
Algeria and Botswana were added to it.
But other countries all around Europe have much longer lists of saying, well, actually, if you come from that country, you're not getting in because you're a safe country. I suspect there's going to be a lot of things like that in advance of the European and local elections.
Well, my last political word on the referendum fallout is that actually I agree, if you want one phrase, and John Major used it a long time ago, back to basics, message to government, ASAP, sort out the housing issue, sort out the planning issue, sort out what's going to happen in terms of jobs and data centres, sort out the health service and the waiting list, and actually stick to that. And anything else is actually going to just antagonise people. But I want to come back to hate speech because I want to put this to you, that there is already a 1989 Prohibition of Incitement to Hatred Act. From February of this year, there's a new Digital Services Act, which provides an EU act, which is now operative.
Which is transposed into Irish law.
Yes, and what it says is that the online abuse, the online platforms have to take responsibility for the content that is disinformation, that's fake news and all of that. So if you have these things, some of them just sort of getting traction, like the Digital Service Act, and if you already have the Incitement to Hatred Act, why do you need a hate speech legislation? Like, this is one thing, if you're smart, you just say, we'll let that for the next government.
Can I surprise you here? Right. And say that's exactly what the government should do, is that there is no political capital to be won and there's lots to be lost by actually pushing on this between now and the time of a general election.
And so why do the government not see this? Because I see McEntee, who doesn't inspire a lot of confidence, let's be honest about it, her political antennae on this. Because I could give you an example now. You tell me if this is hate speech, right? Now, and I'm going to upset you now, and we may have to look at the edit button.
You keep telling me the
point is this. I could turn around and say to you that I find Sharia law absolutely abominable. Stoning people to death, cutting off their limbs and so on. Is that a racist statement?
No. And that wouldn't be covered by the hate speech legislation.
But it actually, Sharia law comes from a religion? Is it? You tell me.
It's an extreme version of Muslim faith. And this idea, I mean, this is again, is what the dangerous stuff that's happening in the UK, for example, and this guy Lee Anderson, who's gone to the Reform UK party and others like that. And this idea that Sadiq Khan, the London mayor, is under the influence of Islamicists. Islamicists is a particular type of extreme Muslim faith. The vast majority of Muslim people would not adhere to that. This idea that London is under the rule of Sharia law, which is what Anderson and others, that's just a lie. And that's liberty trying to inflame people to make them believe that Muslims are interested.
So that's permissible?
No, I'm saying it's real nasty, horrible stuff.
Okay, let me give you another example, which is right on the edge of trouble here.
But what you said earlier, sorry, to tell lies like that, but would you say that I think the vast majority of people would think that Sharia law has no place in what we would want
in civilised law.
In civilised law. There is no problem whatsoever in saying that.
Okay. Now, if I'm to say, and you know, down the country, we talk about the travelling community, and they have other descriptions that are not called travellers and so on. The link between some travellers and crime is to assert that, because now I would meet this in my local area. You say, so a number of houses were robbed or whatever. Oh, the Gardaí privately are saying it's a particular gang and it's this, that and the other. Like, is that racist? Would that be effective? Because, you know,
It would be racist to say that all travellers are thieves. Or that all travellers are, because it would be racist and it would be wrong. But you can say that if there are a certain particular gang who are convicted or whatever, you can say that they are travellers and whatever, just like you can say about settled people. You know, you couldn't say that everybody from Enniscorthy was a drug runner or something like that, could you?
No, but the point about it is this. A lot of people maybe, you know, in the travelling community would be upset that there be any link between their community and this.
They might be upset, but it wouldn't actually constitute a crime under the hate crime legislation.
Okay. Now, the other area where I would say it's justified, if someone was organising the Dublin riots last November, like that would be, in my opinion, because it's leading to criminal damage, that would be so. But I think that's covered under the 1989 Act. And the Gardaí have said there's prosecutions pending for all that.
Yeah, well,
change it?
Well, hang on. The incitement to riot there was actual physical riots or whatever and stuff. I mean, there's a difference in targeting particular people based on the colour of their skin or their ethnicity or their religion or whatever, and calling for violence against people because of that, or because of their background, is something that probably needs to be added in to the existing legislation.
So what I'm saying the government should do is they should go through every line department and say, look, after June, they're not going to be able to deliver anything because the civil servants will stand back, putting their finger in the air, see who my next minister is going to be. But I'm saying all of these problematic issues, which seem to have been pushed by Leo and Micheál and all the rest of it, which are seen to be part of the politically correct agenda, need to be shelved, because you know what? You're going to lose votes.
Oh, you're back to using the old words politically correct. But I'll just remind you that...
Let's go on to another politically incorrect topic, gambling.
No, I just want to remind people that they can get in touch.
You're against drinking, recreational drugs, you're against gambling. That's what I call part of the woke agenda too.
We'll get to that in a second. But if people want to get in contact with us, mail@pathtopowerpodcast.com. And as I said at the outset, many of you who got in touch over the last week have pointed out that Ivan himself has gone to the woke side. And here he is desperately trying to wind his neck back in, having gone heavily for the
You have contaminated me. Absolutely. There is no question. There is no question that if I spend, you know what they say, let lie down long enough with fleas and you'll be scratching yourself after a while. So let's talk about this gambling
I want to talk to you about this.
I find this abhorrent.
You see, recently...
Cheltenham Week that's in it.
How much money have you lost?
No, I'll put it like this. It's still
you've
in play. We're recording this in French.
You've never admitted to losing money when you're gambling,
No,
there
was one horse on Wednesday that did do damage, El Fabiola. But, you know, if Willie Mullins makes money, I only back Willie's horses. And he's had a great week. He's had 100 winners. I'm his biggest devotee. Like, my gambling strategy is... I look for serial winners, whether it's Novak Djokovic, whether it's Max Verstappen, whether it's Tiger Woods back in the day, and I try and find Man City when the stars are aligned, they are going to really be going all out here. And that's my style of betting. I bet at short odds. I keep a meticulous record of accounts of it. I'm a desperate loser. I hate losing. So the reality is I do it partly in recreation because I enjoy those sports.
Okay.
And I enjoy success from those.
Okay, sports. I'm going to tell you something. I don't know whether you've noticed this.
You're against even people having a flutterer.
No, I'm not.
Well, you probably defend the National Lottery to the nth degree.
No, I don't actually. I think the National Lottery is exactly the same as gambling. I think this idea that it's a game. So anyway, leaving that aside, right, and I've no desire to stop anybody gambling, but what I'm really interested in is that this, I suspect, has been the lowest key Cheltenham in public mind in a long time. You're in the bubble. You're in
the
This is no longer commanding the type of... media coverage that it used to. It's been much, much lower key. It's just like another event over the last
year.
You're
absolutely right about that. And can I put that in steroids for you? So you have your big festivals, Leopardstown at Christmas, Dublin Racing Festival in February. You have your Galway, you maybe Derby Day, you've Punchestown. Other than that, I go to Goran Park or Sligo, Thurles. The decline, first of all, the age demographic, they're nearly, like myself, all over 60. Secondly, they're all industry. And there is no doubt, both here and in the UK, racing and gambling is in long-term decline.
Sorry, gambling on racing, because I even noticed...
Right. Down 27% in the UK.
I've even noticed this week on radio that some of the bookmakers are running ads, not for Cheltenham, but they were running ads on cash back if your player is substituted in a football match, that you still, whatever, there's some deal in this. Yeah. Anyway, the point being is that there's two things I think at play here. I think the thing that you've mentioned, I mean, racing is in decline.
The demographic is really bad.
And people are gambling on football and various other things instead of gambling on the outcome of horse races. But secondly, I think an awful lot of the discussion about the dangers of gambling are permeating and is perhaps then influencing the media and the public not to perhaps treating it as harmless fun, as there would have been an awful lot of, particularly during the Celtic Tiger era and then following on after that.
So, well, first of all, let's distinguish between gambling and gaming. Gaming is when you go on to the Paddy Power or Boyle Sports site and you go to roulette games, you go to card games where you're playing against the house. They are done by technology which is guaranteed to give them a high rate of return. I submit, and my experience in bookmaking was very simple, that with the high street, your gross margin was about 12% and your net margin was under 2%, and you had quite a lot of costs. But there would be people who would be backing things at 7-1 that would go off at nearly 2-1, 7-4. and you actually need to close their accounts. So there is skill, there is inside information, and I think we need to differentiate between gambling and gaming. The crack cocaine of it is, but let me just say, the nub of this now is there's a piece of legislation going through the door, which rightly sets up a new regulator who is going to look at all these areas. But it proposes, so racing is on its knees, it proposes that there would be no gambling advertising, no bookmaker advertising from 5:30 in the morning to 9 p.m. at night. Now that will kill not only RT's coverage, Boyle Sports, Paddy Power, TV, Virgin Media's coverage of Cheltenham, all that. That would not be possible without bookie sponsor, and I don't think there is a substitute there. So in all of this, you have subscription channels. So I pay for Sky Sports, as I'm sure you do, but I also pay for something that you don't pay, which is called Racing TV, RTV. And it costs me about €35 a month. I have to be over 18. And it is absolutely, and there's another one called Sporty Stuff, which is greyhound racing.
Are you sure that's about greyhound racing?
No, it's absolutely a six.
Sounds like it might be something else, Ivan.
Now, these are old, hard-bitten, cap on the hat. These are people that are into the betting. What I'm trying to say to you is this. Banning bookmaker advertising will actually put in jeopardy the live coverage of every Irish race. At the moment, right, you go to Gowran Park, there's no one there on a cold Thursday. They get $8,000 per race, seven races, $56,000. That meeting could not be held, even though HRI is putting in 78 million, over 80% of that goes in prize money. So the fact of the matter is that small trainers are starving, small race courses won't survive, and you come along in the name of, and we'll talk about addictive gambling and so on, and what are the statistics on this? Because actually, when you get into it, there's a huge amount of research about problem gambling. There is no doubt the most horrendous stories of addicts, and that has to be dealt with, and they have to be excluded. But the reality of it is that we simply have to not throw everything out, because this is an industry that's worth 2.4 billion, employs 30,000 people.
Sorry, the gambling industry is, no, you mean the horse racing?
No, together, all together. Deloitte did a report for saying all the jobs in the gambling industry in Ireland, all the jobs in the breeding industry, the training industry, the horse rearing industry, all of which is a huge export. Like, those Irish horses are racing in Australia, racing in America. And the fact of the matter is, this, what looks like a minor change in advertising ban to deal with maybe less than 12,000 problem gamblers out of 5.3 million people, please, would you please just stop kicking this industry?
You mentioned €78 million that goes to the horse and greyhound, or the horse racing fund. And there you were a few weeks ago decrying the state giving money to RTE to save a public service that is available to everybody. But when it comes to your own little pet project, your own little love of the horse racing and going to what is something in decline, you want the state to throw 80 million no, quid a year no, no. towards it.
And what do they get back? It's 16 million for the greyhound racing industry, and it's 78 million for the horse industry.
Oh God, it's even worse than I thought.
The return on that investment is unbelievable. The return on the investment in RTE is like a leaking bucket. The money is going into a black hole.
But into a black hole in the horse racing and greyhound.
The jobs that it's creating.
You've already told us about how it's declining.
No.
And look at all the prize money. The prize money rewarding wealthy people who are having their playthings with their horses and given to the trainers.
This is another problem. There is now a clear pyramid structure in racing, whereby the wealthiest owners are winning the most races, and that is probably reflecting in the likes of, Willie Mullins is a great phrase, give me a great owner rather than a great horse. You know, because they can afford to have, you know, lots of stumers and lots of misspent money. And the ratio is horse owners. And when I was minister, I got this checked out. How do you make a euro as a racehorse owner? You invest €6. For every six you invest, you get one. They are subsidising the business.
You're talking about 25 years ago and things have changed. And, you know, even in Cheltenham, when you see, in some respects, you know, a few years ago, there was this great pride. Oh, suddenly the Irish are able to win more races than the British. Do you know what that now says to me? Because this has become a consistent thing. That just shows the decline in the English horse racing industry as much as it shows the lift in the Irish horse racing industry. And it also shows that overall, this is a sport that's coming towards its end.
Well, put it like this. If welfare people like you and woke people had their way, that would be the case. The fact of the matter is, there are two things Ireland has given to the world authentically. One is drink, Guinness, and whiskey and drink, and the other is the Irish thoroughbred. And we should be proud of our heritage. We should be proud that we are world leaders in this. And simply because of political correctness, you know, we're going to have an advertising ban, which is going to undermine a whole industry. And I'm sorry, but it's from where you sit in Dublin 6, that's fine and dandy. If you're down in the arsehole of Tipperary trying to scrape a living, or like Shark Hanlon trying to, you know, have a few horses that you might buy and sell and so on. These people are not wealthy people, and they are keeping a rural tradition. You go into most pubs where I drink and you'll see Istabrak or Dawn Run on the wall. This runs
1980s,
deep.
1980s stuff, is it?
No, and I know it's easy to be snide and derided.
I'm really happy I picked this topic for you to get worked up about.
Well, can I talk about poor Charlie Bird?
Go on, yes.
Well, so, sad news this week, yes. Not a surprise. And, you know, can I say, I've had really serious battles with Charlie. Can I tell you, the worst of all was, and this was knockdown, dragout, in the 1997 election. So I was minister at this time, we were at the Rainbow Government holding on. So I went on the last Monday before voting day. I went on to questions and answers. And, you know, John Bowman, or whoever was, asked me, and why is it that John Bruton is doing so badly on the polls relative to Bertie? I said, that's no surprise to me. Every night on the 9 o'clock news, you have a breathless, passionate Charlie Bird running around, you know,
He followed Bertie Ahern around the country. Yeah.
And I said, no, and then you have pedestrian Joe O'Brien, a lovely fella, and one comes across as a superhero and the other comes across as a piece of mutton. The fact of the matter, so I railed against this. So what happened was, the next day, the Taoiseach is looking for you. And I said, what? So he said, Charlie Bird has threatened to resign from the campaign, that you've accused him of being partisan and unprofessional. I said, feck it, John, I told the truth. You know what I mean? And it was in your interest that this be told, and so on. And he said, well, he rang me back again and he said, no, you must withdraw it and you must apologise. And I said, I will in my S-H-1-T. So anyway, it got very serious then, and he was going to resign. And the truth is, I had to eat humble pie, because that's what you do in politics. So that was number one. Number two then, so it was very bad. And I have to say, over the years, Charlie did not strike me. I would describe you and Sean O'Rourke and other people, really respect people in journalism. I would consider them cerebral, and maybe more cerebral even than me. Maybe lacking a lot of common sense. But the fact of the fact of the matter is, I never regarded Charlie as cerebral. But he had this empathy of connecting with people. He was the news. If Charlie was covering the story, like, he became a political chief correspondent, he became the news by virtue of him covering it. Then the last time I met him, so I was doing this gig for the All-Ireland Business Summit in December in Croke Park, and he was there with Trigger and Clare, and he was raising money for the Samaritans. And you know Brent Pope's elephant.
Yes, the elephant in the room.
For mental health,
yes.
And it's really good. And to be honest with you, and he was crying and he got a standing ovation. We actually, before that, had made our peace, because he used to come into News Talk quite a lot, and he really believed in public sector broadcasting, whereas you might have gathered that I don't.
Yeah, really?
And so the point is this. We actually agreed to disagree on that. But he will be greatly missed. In his heyday, he was a legend.
It was a very cruel illness as well that he suffered.
Absolutely.
And I think it was,
what was your take on him?
Well, he did use the circumstances of an illness, which is very, very cruel. And in some respects, the cruelty of it is, a lot of people, they get it at an earlier age. He was unusual in how late he was in life.
74, when he passed away.
But most people who get it tend to be in their 30s and 40s. And because their metabolism is faster, they tend to go very quickly. They can be gone often in 6 months. Whereas probably because he was older, then it dragged out a bit. He was very fortunate in that they were able to use the voice technology to continue giving him a voice.
To great effect.
And this is a wonderful thing with technology as well, is there was so much material that they were able to use that were in the archives from him, that they were able to give him a more effective voice than they would have been able to give other people. So I think there was an enormous degree of respect for the work that he did in relation to fundraising and charity and all the rest
of it. And as a journalist, is his role with the IRA in terms of being respected by that and communicating the dirt tax?
He
did the state a lot of service.
Indeed. Our sympathies very much to his family and friends. And it was a very tough last few years for him. And I think that everybody very much acknowledges that.
May he rest in peace.
Indeed. Okay, that's it for today's edition of Path to Power. As I said, if you want to get
in
contact with us,
I hope I straightened you out on a few things.
And if you want to you straighten Ivan out for having gone over to the other side, please send your emails to mail@pathtopowerpodcast.com. And we will be back again next week. Again, as I always say, please subscribe, be it on Apple or Spotify, wherever it is that you actually get your podcasts. And please recommend us to a friend. We're discovering that for all the people who are telling us how much they enjoy the podcast, there are others who know absolutely nothing about it. So let them know, please. So until the next time, from me, Matt Cooper.
And from me, Ivan Yates.
Goodbye.